The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You know, both were kind of trying to run down the clock and see what happens. You know, the Ghani government wanted, you know, an extension. The Taliban essentially wanted the U.S. to leave without making any compromises. But I'd argue that now the Taliban has zero incentive. And we'll wait to see what happens. They've given, you know, statements saying basically that they won't engage in peace talks until all U.S. forces withdraw. And we'll see, you know, what their reaction is more so in the coming days, but I would expect to see, you know, zero movement on this.
I'm Bryce Clem, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, April 16th, 2021. On Wednesday, President Biden announced a full withdrawal of all U.S. military personnel from Afghanistan by September 11th, 2021. The withdrawal announcement comes as the U.S. and Afghan governments have been trying to reach a power-sharing agreement with the Taliban. Negotiations began in September 2020 because of an agreement reached in February 2020 when the Trump administration made an initial deal with the Taliban. That deal said that the U.S. would withdraw by May 1st, 2021. A lot has happened since that February deal, and to help us make sense of it all, I first spoke with Thomas Gibbons Neff, a New York Times correspondent based in the Kabul Bureau and former Marine infantryman. Thomas walked us through the situation on the ground in Afghanistan since that February agreement. Following Biden's announcement, I spoke with Medea Afzal, the David M. Rubenstein Fellow in the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution, to go through the broader implications of a U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. Quick note, I recorded the interview with Thomas Gibbons Neff before President Biden's withdrawal announcement. It's the Lawfare Podcast, April 16th, Biden announces a military withdrawal from Afghanistan. Great, Thomas, thank you so much for joining me. Before we get into sort of the more recent negotiations, I think it's really important to discuss the terms of the February 2020 deal that the U.S. made with the Taliban and how that tracks to the current situation in Afghanistan. So if you could just sort of walk us through the conditions of that deal and to what extent, at least in the past year plus, the parties have lived up to their commitments in that deal.
Right, sure. Yeah, thanks for having me. So, you know, basically the February 29th, 2020, it's called the Doha deal, kind of set the stage for where we are now. And, you know, the big points of that deal, right, was that there would be a U.S. withdrawal by May 1st of this year, right, and that, you know, given a prisoner release and a commitment to basically start negotiations between the Taliban and the Afghan government would follow. And kind of what happened afterward, there was a delay in the prisoner release, so that kind of moved things down the road a bit. And when finally 5,000 Taliban prisoners were released after much haranguing between the U.S. and the Afghan government, the Ghani administration in September of last year, intra-Afghan negotiations began in Doha. And those have kind of crawled along. There were some issues about the preface of the deal, kind of what would be discussed and how it would be laid out in December, and that was resolved. And now we're kind of here in this. There's still been negotiations between the Afghan negotiators and the Taliban negotiators, but the needle really hasn't moved too much to the right. So the new administration came in basically set some conditions down or sent a letter to President Ghani and basically set us up to where we are now as these approaching Istanbul talks. If they happen today, the Taliban said they were not go to Istanbul on the 16th, but that doesn't mean they won't go in the days afterward.
Yeah. Yeah. So I just want to return to what happened in the aftermath of the Doha deal and just sort of how did that change, if at all, the level of violence on the ground in Afghanistan?
Right. So, I mean, before the Doha deal was signed, Zalmay Khalilzad, the U.S. peace envoy, you know, had wanted some type of ceasefire written into the deal. And the best that he got was this week-long, quote-unquote, reduction in violence that led up to the deal where, you know, it wasn't a ceasefire, but there was a sharp decline in incidents up to the February 29th signing. And while not explicitly written in the deal, there was hopes that there would be a drop-off similar to the week-long reduction of violence before the deal was signed afterward. But that didn't happen. I mean, I guess if you look at the UN statistics from 2020, you know, the amount of civilian casualties did drop by 15% compared to 2019. And I think below 10,000, which was a first since 2013. So you could say, hey, listen, like, you know, the Taliban could say, yeah, we've reduced violence over the last year. But in reality, the violence kind of changed, right? In the February 2020 deal, you had the quote unquote classified annexes, or basically sections that, as it's been explained to me by several people, were more general guidelines on what both sides basically shouldn't do, right? So the Taliban shouldn't attack district centers. The Americans wouldn't conduct drone strikes. There would be no offensive operations on either side, whether that was the Afghan American NATO or the Taliban. And what the Americans will accuse the Taliban of doing is kind of navigating in the gray area of that deal. And what you see really the Americans point to is the most concrete example of them navigating that area is the targeted assassination campaign that's kind of been going on for now over a year.
Right, right. And I wanted to, you did some reporting on that. So I was wondering, you know, nobody's claimed responsibility for these targeted killings in Afghanistan, but a lot of people believe the Taliban are responsible. So who is being targeted in these killings and why do you think whoever's doing them, most likely the Taliban, is doing them?
Right. So I think the U.S. came out in the last few months and kind of it was the first time they said directly that the Taliban were behind most of these attacks. The Taliban obviously have denied it, but the targets, you know, go from religious scholars to civil society members to soldiers and police, doctors, judges, you know, civil society, I think is the best way to kind of characterize it. So you can never say all of these attacks are by the Taliban, even though they go unclaimed, right? You know, there are people operating again in that gray space, taking advantage of the chaos. Maybe, you know, settling deals, you know, settling disputes, tribal issues, family issues. We had written about, I think, something in Gore province where, you know, a journalist had information about a provincial council member and that provincial council member had that journalist killed. And, you know, again, there's just a lot of gray area where these kind of attacks can happen as well. So, you know, you can look at it as a couple things, right? It's especially in Kabul, it gets a lot of attention, a lot of news coverage, and you know, the Taliban use that to their advantage, whether it be, you know, propaganda or pushing this message that, you know, the government can't even protect its people in the capital, right? That kind of serves well. And then again, it's also a way to show their relevance. Say, you know, the Taliban think that they're, you know, agreeing to these conditions in the classified annexes, and then they use this type of violence instead of, you know, massive car bomb attacks in the district centers or trying to capture Kunduz, and instead kind of sow this creeping fear across the country, right? Because it's not just in Kabul, it's in other cities and towns across the country.
Yeah, I want to just return for our listeners who might not have been following the reporting on the classified annexes. So these were a part of the February 2020 deal, as you mentioned. What's really strange about them is that they were classified
through official channels to the American public, but, you know, the Taliban were party to the deal, so they had access to them. I'm just wondering, sort of in your view and your reporting, what was so important about these annexes to keep them classified from the American public, but not the Taliban?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a question that everybody has. I mean, I think it has a lot to do with how the Americans will withdraw, you know, these ideas of, you know, reducing violence or putting guidelines in place, and how the parties of the conflict will conduct themselves over the duration of the deal or what have you. So, I mean, it's kind of a mystery to me, whether it was part of the negotiations where this wouldn't be publicized or not, but that's just kind of where it stands. I mean, the Taliban has access to it and kind of could use that to their advantage. And I think in the end, especially when it comes to these restrictions on violence, right, whether, you know, no suicide bombings, no drone strikes, no raids, no offensives, you can kind of define it how you want or accuse the other of a violation, other side of a violation, when it could be one way or interpreted one way or another.
Right. And I want to move for a second and talk about the U.S. relationship with the Afghan government and, you know, supposed to be very close allies. But I was wondering if you could just sort of walk us through some of the key differences in their view on what a negotiated settlement would look like.
Right. I mean, I think that kind of plays out every day, you know, to separate yourself from President Ghani's administration and the palace, and then the kind of political power holders, whether that's Hekmatyar, whether that's Jaimat, you know, whether that's, you know, Dostum's party. You know, you have so many people kind of around in the political sphere that has push and pull, or at least think they do, when it comes to, you know, what a negotiated settlement will look like. So in turn, you have, I think I've heard more than 30 different types of, you know, peace plans that have been circulated that the High Council that Abdullah Abdullah leads has to go through before they put any plan forward, you know, in the Istanbul negotiations. So, I mean, I think the Americans have a concrete idea of what they'd hope to get out of Turkey or out of the talks or whatever comes out of Doha and Turkey together. But again, you know, President Ghani has his own peace plan and his own perception of what a negotiated settlement will look like. And at the end of the day, I think it comes down to being on the Americans' timeline, which he obviously does not want to be.
Right. And you mentioned Secretary of State Blinken's letter to Ghani. I was wondering if you could just walk us through, you know, what was in that letter and how was it received within the Afghan government?
Right. I mean, in that letter, you could kind of argue what the tone was. I mean, it was definitely harsh, and that, you know, the palace, Ghani's palace, did not expect that tone from Secretary Blinken, you know, and the fact that they thought that maybe Khalilzad had written it, because there's some animosity between Ghani and Khalilzad, and Blinken was detached from the process and just kind of gave Khalilzad free rein to kind of get what, you know, he thought should be pushed across the plate, you know, as we get closer to May 1st. But basically, it outlined their idea of, you know, a interim government or a, you know, a peace plan that would involve all parts of society, and, you know, a reduction in violence that could lead to a ceasefire. And as it was explained to me, you know, there was this idea that, hey, the U.S. is putting this together. It's not something that they think, you know, the Afghans should adhere to the letter. It's just, you know, there wasn't much movement in Doha. So here's this plan that can be discussed between, you know, the Taliban and the Afghan negotiators and the political parties in Kabul, right? It was just trying to throw something at the wall to see what could come out of it. And, you know, in reality, I think President Ghani took it as a slight, just because of the tone of the letter, who was mentioned in it, Karzai, the former president. And so, yeah, it definitely kind of the honeymoon phase of, oh, well, the Trump administration's left, the Biden administration's here, we can see eye to eye on things, you know, they'll understand where we're coming from, was kind of, I don't want to say shattered, that's a little dramatic, but definitely tainted.
Right. I mean, there's been some reporting on how a lot of people are upset with President Ghani and the way that he's conducted himself with the peace talks. I mean, in Doha, there was a diplomatic holdup about the basic name of the Afghan government that would be referred to in official documents. What leverage does Ghani and the Afghan government have really left in your view in these negotiations?
I mean, I think there's a bunch of perspectives when it comes to Ghani's leverage, right? There's this idea that, if you were to put an interim government in place, the country would be more destabilized than it is already, given the violence and the pending withdrawal date of, American and NATO forces. But, it's just kind of, he's the president. He has a relationship with the U.S. There's the Afghan security forces that are, for now, a reliable counterterrorism partner for the U.S. And, part of the Doha deal is the further release of Taliban prisoners. And while it's not written in there as a definitive term, it is a goal that the Americans are supposed to aspire to and ideally commit to, as well as taking the Taliban off the United Nations sanctions list. I mean, it'll be up to Ghani if those prisoners are released, but at the same time, he is the president of the country, and I think that's enough leverage for him for now. I mean, it depends what happens going forward as far as, there's lots of talk, and especially from some of Ghani's subordinates, if American troops leave, that there'll be a civil war, which was not a talking point for a while until in the last year it started to be repeated publicly as kind of a threat, right? The last thing the U.S. wants is a, Afghanistan torn apart like the 90s, that is a breeding ground for terrorists and insurgent groups.
Right. And I was wondering if you could sort of describe what happens. The Taliban's made some territorial gains over the past year. And I was wondering if you could describe what happens in those areas that the Taliban moves in. I mean, what sort of policies are implemented, and how does the lives of the Afghan civilians who are sort of caught in the middle of this conflict, how does that change once they move into an area?
Right. I mean, it's always kind of a tough question and a tough thing to kind of pull apart. But the Taliban, they have long been celebrated, I guess, by rural Afghans who appreciate their immediacy, right? That like land disputes can be settled quickly, neighborly issues, again, fast resolution. I mean, this idea that, you can live your life and that the justice system and the government is right next door versus, the bloated, corrupt bureaucracy of the Kabul government. If, you were in a rural village in Helmand province that was not controlled by the Taliban, but controlled by, Afghan forces, right? So in those areas, you have examples of in government-controlled areas that people will just settle land disputes by going into Taliban-controlled areas and, talking to their legal system. But as far as, in the last year, I think the big two offensives that got a lot of attention were those in Kandahar and Helmand. And I think we're not really at a spot where you can kind of say like how things change in those areas as far as if the Taliban have brought in their governing system. I mean, in Panjwani, for example, I was there a month or so ago when talking to people who live in the Taliban controlled areas, Taliban are very present. They have a curfew. They put in a lot of roadside bombs that, after 5 p.m., they are quote unquote activated, so people can't go to their fields or, can't leave their house at night. And then during the day, they can't go to their fields because they've basically laid bombs in those fields to stop any, government advance. But again, if you talk to people from those places, they'll kind of say, well, the Taliban isn't as corrupt as the government. I mean, it's a very low bar, right? And I'm trying to walk the line of not saying like, well, the Taliban have their stuff together and the Afghan government doesn't, but it's just these kind of two sides of the same coin.
Right. And I mean, there was one great article that you wrote about white high top sneakers. And there is a point to this article, but you explained how the Taliban can be sort of identified by these white high top sneakers that are made in Pakistan, I think, if that's correct. But they're trying to sort of distance themselves from that because they want to be seen as more of a legitimate organization. Would you say that's correct?
Yeah. I mean, I think you know, everyone has in their head, like the training video, the Al-Qaeda training videos from the 90s of guys like jumping through flaming hoops. That, I guess that kind of exists in some way, but the Taliban have gone kind of out of their way as far, especially as far as their uniforms are concerned, their training videos to show themselves as a potent nation state military force, right? Where they're wearing boots and camouflage uniforms that look like you would see in a military unit.
Right. And is that an outcome of the February 2020 deal as they negotiate and they're sort of posturing to be a part of a negotiated settlement government?
Right. I mean, I think that's one of their big, you know, information operations campaign or STRATCOM, whatever you want to call it, PR, is that they want to put themselves up against the Western-backed Afghan government as this viable alternative that has learned from its, you know, governing mistakes of the 90s and is capable of running a country. I mean, whether that's true or not, yet to be seen, but you know, again, it's definitely an image that they want to portray.
Yeah, definitely. I want to move to you reported on some talks between the U.S. negotiating directly with the Taliban again because the Afghan government and Taliban are stalled. So what's been the status of those negotiations? And I was wondering if you could talk about how a recent CIA-backed militia incident affected their situation.
Yeah, sure. I mean, so there's been a lot of talk about, you know, the reduction in violence, right? The annexes of the 2020 deal and this push to somehow curb the violence ahead of any further peace talks. Now, people, experts, analysts, officials, you'll say, you know, what's the sequencing? Do you have the peace talks, some kind of deal from that? Or a, you know, movement and then a reduction of violence, or you need a reduction of violence to get to the peace talks. So the Americans, I mean, since, you know, for months after the February 2020 deal, have kind of pushed to redefine or, you know, build on these annexes because, you know, the Americans believe they need to be more stringent and enforced, or at least stringent enough that, you know, the Taliban don't operate in this gray space and there isn't this miscommunication because, you know, there's these biweekly meetings, you know, called the mill-to-mill channels or the communication channel between the U.S. and the Taliban that take place in Doha that kind of has just devolved into, you know, one side says you did this, the other side says you did that. And it just kind of gets left there because, you know, again, from the annexes that I haven't seen, it's just not exactly clear on what both sides should or shouldn't be doing. Or if it does say, they just take advantage of it. So these talks have kind of been this, the reduction of violence talks that the Americans have been involved in. And, you know, up until now is this idea that, you know, if you can get 90 days of reduced violence, kind of like those 7 days before the February 2020 deal, you know, maybe, you know, the front lines stabilize and you can kind of set almost like an equilibrium for the conflict, right? That, you know, those 90 days will turn into 120 days and so on and so forth. And the Taliban have been really reticent to kind of agree to these things despite being dangled, you know, maybe another prisoner release, maybe the sanctions release or sanctions lift, because they don't want to be pushed into a ceasefire. Because as soon as you have a stabilized front line, you know, getting your fighters to go back to war is a lot harder than not. Right. I mean, it's basically, you know, you cool them down and heating the Taliban back up. It's difficult. And a lot of frontline commanders, Taliban commanders, are worried about that, from what I understand.
Right. And how, I want to touch on that a little bit more, sort of how is the Taliban posturing prior to the May 1 withdrawal deadline? Because it, from all indications, it seems like the U.S. will probably stay in Afghanistan past May 1. How have the Taliban been positioning themselves around the country?
Yeah, I mean, I think the two examples that you can kind of point to is as Taliban posture. I mean, they've said repeatedly that, you know, if the U.S. goes past the May 1st deadline, that there will be attacks on U.S. NATO installations. And that was kind of apparent at the end of March, where these CIA-backed militia forces allegedly killed dozens of civilians in Khost province, and the Taliban responded by publicly announcing that the Taliban shelled FOB Chapman, Camp Chapman, whatever you want to call it, the CIA base down there that's well known, has some U.S. military there for force protection and working with the agency. So that was the first instance. And then, you know, a week or so later, there was an attack on Kandahar airfield that the Taliban also publicly acknowledged after, you know, U.S. airstrikes were hitting Taliban fighters in Argandab, a district to the west of Kandahar city proper. So you have these two incidents that the Taliban publicly acknowledged and took credit for. You know, in the past, there had been some shellings of U.S. bases in southern Afghanistan that had just kind of been denied. There was a car bomb at Camp Chapman that no one took credit for. So definitely past May 1st, I'm sure there'll be more of that if American troops are still in Afghanistan, but we'll see.
Right. And sort of in the spring season, typically sees an increase in fighting, but especially when you take, you know, that in conjunction with a May 1 withdrawal deadline. The U.S. recently, I guess, had an intelligence assessment that you reported on that detailed a classified intelligence assessment that detailed what would happen if the U.S. did withdraw by the May 1st deadline. So what did that scenario look like?
Right. I mean, I think that that assessment, I think, was reported before the Biden administration took office. But again, it basically said, you know, kind of much what, you know, the intelligence community assessed in the late 80s, you know, that if the Soviets withdraw, you know, the Najibullah government will fall relatively quickly. You know, in this assessment, they said the Taliban will take over in 2 to 3 years. And to me, I mean, it seemed kind of, you know, more like a swipe at the American, you know, attempt to prop up the Afghan security forces, right? Defense forces, that in 2 to 3 years, you know, the Taliban will be able to militarily defeat, you know, this infrastructure that the U.S. and NATO and allies took 2 decades to build and train. Now, granted, I think, you know, the assessment didn't say, you know, how much funding that the government would still get if there would be airstrikes from outside the country that would still attack the Taliban. So, I mean, there was definitely some unknowns, but I think the intelligence community, the Pentagon, are all kind of saying the same thing to the Biden administration to not announce a withdrawal.
Right. And you're in Kabul right now. So I was wondering if you could just sort of describe for us the atmosphere in Kabul. I mean, I've seen reporting in recent days that there's been an increase in violence just around the city.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, since the deal, there's just this unknown, right? I mean, there's just no idea what the future looks like. And I think that was the most apparent around the presidential elections and the inauguration, right, where it was this, you know, if Trump was going to win, which meant, you know, the fate was sealed, that the Americans would withdraw and the Afghans, especially those in Kabul, would be dealing with a much different future. And now it's kind of the same. It's kind of just waiting for this review announcement that could come this week, could come next week, could come on May 1st. But I mean, that level of uncertainty has been a huge part of Afghan culture for the last 40 years. And yeah, it's tough. And I mean, with the targeted assassinations in Kabul and other cities, it's a lot of pressure, weighs on a lot of people.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, what's it like, just sort of moving to more of your own personal experience, what's it like reporting from Kabul in this time?
You know, it's just taking into account this security situation. I mean, what I was just thinking about is, you know, 13 years ago, I was a Lance Corporal in the Marines, and we were getting ready to go on this operation in Helmand Province, and we had no idea, you know, when it was going to be, what exactly our role was. So we're just kind of, it was just hurry up and wait. And now here we are, mid-April 2021, and I'm trying to figure out when this peace conference in Turkey is going to happen. How am I going to get there? Is the Taliban going to go? So it's kind of just a weird comparison of perspectives, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, do you find that people are more hesitant to talk to you than they have been sort of in the past as we approach this May 1st deadline, or is there really no difference there?
No, I mean, it's, I think there's being an American, and again, I wasn't a reporter. I've only been here for a short amount of time as a reporter, well, in and out since 2015. But, you know, I think when you kind of announce yourself as American, there's some contempt there. I mean, I think there's, especially in Kabul, this idea that we've hung them out to dry. We've emboldened the Taliban and then kind of gave them these prisoners that, you know, they claim many return to the battlefield. So, yeah, it's just, it's, yeah, definitely perspective on the United States is certainly soured. It's hard to push back on that.
Yeah. You know, do you have any sort of, not that you're in the predicting market, but do you have any anticipation for what these talks in Istanbul will look like?
No, I think, you know, any kind of progress will just look like some kind of agreement on, you know, what the future talks will look like, what the topics that need to be discussed and decided upon when it comes to, you know, future government or future political settlement or ceasefire, right? It's just this idea of what to approach and how to approach it from the negotiators from both sides. I think that would be progress. I don't see any major, you know, I don't see both sides walking away having figured everything out, right? It's just more of, you know, pushing this closer and closer to a political settlement. So I think that would be a big takeaway.
Thank you so much for joining me. I want to start with President Biden's announcement on Wednesday. He announced a final withdrawal date of September 11th, 2021. You previously have advocated for the U.S. to hold the Taliban to its commitments in the Doha deal, which was made in February 2021, and then assess the withdrawal date from there. So I just really was wondering what your initial reaction to the announcement was.
Sure. I was struck by the announcement. I mean, I think there is, for September 11th, I think President Biden wanted to sort of end the war with some symbolism, having 20 years after the 9/11 attacks be sort of the bookend to the war, or at least the U.S. involvement in the war. And so he chose that date, presumably for that reason. But what was striking to me was, in the withdrawal announcement, the fact that it was entirely unconditional. Even President Trump, you know, who certainly wanted, you know, to end America's endless wars, as he constantly said, signed a peace deal with the Taliban in Doha last year that made U.S. withdrawal conditional on a number of things, you know, on even on sort of the kind of barest reading of the Doha deal on counterterrorism commitments, and by some readings of that deal on other things as well, on progress in the intra-Afghan peace process, on a reduction in violence by the Taliban. So, you know, there were certainly conditions that a lot of us at that point deemed were not enough. And the fact is that this withdrawal announcement basically disconnects from any of those commitments. It does none of that. And that, to me, is really striking, coming as it does from President Biden and coming as it does on the heels of, you know, now nearly 3 months of a review process that this administration has undertaken, in which they haven't said a lot, but they have talked about preserving the gains made in women's rights and human rights and democracy over the last 20 years. And so they've given indications that they would respect sort of the conditionality of at least the Doha deal, and perhaps even impose more conditions. But here, all of that is being rolled away.
Right. And I, you know, you touched on the intra-Afghan negotiations, and you've been following them very closely. So I was just wondering, how do you think this announcement will impact the ongoing negotiations between the Afghan government and the Taliban?
Unfortunately, I would argue that this announcement and the fact that there is an exact date by which withdrawal will be complete, right? Withdrawal will begin on May 1st, President Biden said, and will be complete by September 11th. So the fact that there's an exact date and the fact that there is no conditionality to that withdrawal essentially means that there is no incentive for the Taliban to compromise on anything or to even come back to the table, frankly. And so I would say that the peace process is effectively over. And for that reason, you know, for those in Afghanistan who wanted some kind of peace agreement, right? And those of us who thought that that would be the best way to exit this war, you know, it's a tough day, a tough week with this announcement. I think I would say the Taliban obviously had very little incentive to compromise earlier. And I think, you know, to be fair, the Ghani government also wasn't engaging in a lot of compromise. You know, both were kind of trying to run down the clock and see what happens. You know, the Ghani government wanted, you know, an extension. The Taliban essentially wanted the U.S. to leave without making any compromises. But I'd argue that now the Taliban has zero incentive. And we'll wait to see what happens. They've given, you know, statements saying basically that they won't engage in peace talks until all U.S. forces withdraw. And we'll see, you know, what their reaction is more so in the coming days. But I would expect to see, you know, zero movement on this.
Right. That's interesting. I was talking with Thomas Gibbons Neff, who wrote an article last April on the U.S. using the CIA presence in Afghanistan as a leverage point in negotiations. And something that I found sort of interesting about President Biden's announcement, there was a background call that a senior administration official did with some reporters, where they basically said that the U.S. will sort of keep its intelligence, or try to keep some semblance of an intelligence apparatus there to ensure that another attack is not launched in the United States from Afghan soil. And I was wondering, do you think that, you know, the intelligence presence at all could still be a bargaining chip for the negotiations?
I don't think that the intelligence presence there can be used as leverage. What I would say is that troops could be used as leverage only because we could predicate our withdrawal on some kind of progress in peace negotiations or any other conditions that we wanted fulfilled. But I think the intelligence presence will be useful, even if it's limited, in being able to make sure that our counterterrorism sort of purposes are met, right? So one of the criticisms of withdrawal without knowing what happens next in terms of the Taliban gaining ascendance in Afghanistan or a civil war, et cetera, is that, you know, you cede space essentially to terrorist groups, you know, the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, which may want to attack the U.S. And so that intelligence presence is useful. It will be limited. And I think President Biden has also talked about, and the senior administration official in that call also spoke about repositioning our presence in the region so that, you know, basically we can sort of keep an eye on this. I mean, I'd be curious in the coming days and weeks to see exactly what that looks like. But by definition, an offshore presence is not going to be as effective as, you know, what we have right now. So the fact is that some of this, you know, will be diluted. Some of our abilities will be diluted. And I think there is a recognition of that across the administration. I think the decision basically says the threat that we face, you know, we can deal with that diluted presence, and we don't need to keep boots on the ground for counterterrorism purposes.
Right. And you touched on this a little bit earlier, but in speaking about the gains made by women and girls in Afghanistan over the past 20 years, the senior administration official said that the U.S. would use diplomatic, humanitarian, and economic tools to protect those gains. I was wondering, do you think that's a viable strategy given the fundamental differences between the current Afghan government and the Taliban?
Right. You know, that's I do worry about that quite a bit. And President Biden, to be fair, has been clear on this since the campaign trail. Last February, when he was a candidate for president, he said on Face the Nation that he basically bore zero responsibility for the outcome if the Taliban ends up back in control and women end up losing their rights. So he's been consistent on this. He basically has said that we don't need to maintain troops in order to guarantee rights, or we don't need to send troops somewhere in order to guarantee women's rights. But I think the difference here is that we already had an existing and ongoing presence, and that presence could have been used to reach a peace deal where we would know what the conclusion would be for those rights. I mean, I will say that even with some kind of power sharing agreement between the Taliban and Kabul, some of those rights would have to be rolled back, probably, as the Taliban asserted its ideology and its beliefs. But, you know, at least we would know what the outcome is. Right now, my fear is, and others have warned of this as well, that Afghanistan enters into some kind of state of protracted violence and civil war where, you know, the fight goes to its cities, which is where women have seen the most gains and most progress in terms of rights, in terms of girls going to school, women going to work. And there they first face a security threat. And then second, of course, if the Taliban is able to gain some ascendance there, they see all of the progress of the last 20 years being washed away. And I think that is a real threat and a potentially great cost. I think that will be of great cost to the U.S., which is something that is being disregarded or at least pushed aside or pushed down the horizon in this decision. I think, to me, this decision seems like it's made from kind of a short and medium term perspective. But in the long term, you know, there's a real risk that outcomes could go awry because of it. And that's not being considered.
Right, right. And I want to get into that. You co-authored an article that sort of walked through why staying in Afghanistan was, in your words, the least bad choice for the Biden administration. And you walk through some scenarios of what would happen in Afghanistan post-U.S. withdrawal, and some really horrifying scenarios, including ethnic cleansing. I was wondering if you could take us through some of those scenarios.
Sure. I think, you know, the first point that my co-author Michael Hanlon and I make in that piece is that if, you know, our assistance to Afghan government forces continues, they will have the wherewithal to maintain the fight with the Taliban. And the Taliban certainly will. So they will keep on fighting. So those who imagine some sort of quick Taliban victory over the Kabul government and some kind of smooth transition to the Taliban being in power, I think are mistaken. So the war will continue. And we have all sort of would say that it is likely to move into Afghanistan's cities as well. And given that, you know, there could be some scenarios in which we might see some form of ethnic cleansing where, because the Taliban are Pashtun, the other ethnic groups would want to push them out as they're fighting against the Taliban. And that could, again, be a recipe for ethnic cleansing. And what you might see there is some kind of partition of the country that occurs. You know, one part of the, you know, current Afghan state that becomes a part that is, again, friendly to the U.S., and then one part that falls into Taliban control. And of course, then that part would be of threat to us. I think another implication is that this would sort of increase the likelihood that a huge amount of refugees might flow into Pakistan, which neighbors Afghanistan. And of course, we've seen this before, right? We've seen this all play out before in terms of what happened in the 1990s, where after the Soviet withdrawal, huge amounts of refugees fled into Pakistan, really changing sort of the makeup of Pakistan's northwest, where, you know, there was a huge degree of sort of gun culture that came out, increased militancy later. And, you know, some might argue that, you know, Pakistan, as it did then, would have incentive to prop up a Taliban regime in Afghanistan. But Pakistan has sort of made it clear that it is not the Pakistan of the 1990s. And there are a number of reasons for that. And one is the fact that it has had its own experience with militancy and terrorism over the last 20 years. And so it is not in its interest, and it has said as much, to have you know, a Taliban emirate on its western border. So Pakistan is not going to be the power that props up the Taliban necessarily. So what we would see then is some kind of, you know, huge refugee flows into Pakistan, and that could have massive repercussions in and of itself. You know, Pakistan is the fifth largest country in the world. It is a nuclear power, and a destabilization of Pakistan has ripple effects and more throughout the region.
Right. And so I want to jump in here. This is a good segue to my next question, which is just how do you think this announcement has been received in Pakistan? And could the U.S. withdrawal give Pakistan sort of a larger role in Afghanistan and the broader negotiations that are going on right now?
So let me start with, you know, Pakistan's role throughout the Afghan peace process. You know, Pakistan has played a constructive role here. It brought the Taliban to the table. It released Mullah Baradar, and that's how the talks began. Pakistan really has been sort of the, other than the U.S. and, you know, then the Taliban, sort of the third party here in this peace process. And it's sort of the centrality of its role has remained. The Biden administration is talking about and talking to other countries as well. You know, it's talked about bringing India in, you know, Russia is involved. There was a conference in Moscow last month. But I think Pakistan's central role remains intact. In the power sharing agreement that the Biden administration was trying to broker between the Taliban and Kabul, with the leak letter that came out from Secretary Blinken to President Ghani last month, you know, that was something that Pakistan said it supported, and it said it was on board. And now it's saying it's on board with a U.S. withdrawal as well. It had said that it would prefer for there not to be a precipitous withdrawal, but clearly it doesn't consider this sort of withdrawal, this withdrawal that takes about 4 months, as a precipitous one. I mean, I would argue that this decision essentially by the Biden administration has been made for logistical purposes, right? To stagger the withdrawal so that it's done responsibly. And that's what responsible withdrawal means for the Biden administration. And so this, you know, at least overtly seems to satisfy Pakistan. Secretary Blinken had a phone call with the Chief of Army Staff, General Bajwa. And today, you know, General Bajwa has said that he is on board. President Biden, in his speech yesterday, said, you know, he'll call on regional countries to do more to support Afghanistan. And then he sort of stressed, especially Pakistan. Then he mentioned some other countries, including India and Iran. And so the question is, what does do more mean for Pakistan? And I'm sure Pakistanis are curious about this because they've begrudged in many ways the U.S. demand to do more. They say, you know, they've essentially used all their leverage to bring the Taliban to the table. And they've said they have limited leverage over the Taliban in terms of what they can ask it to do. And in that, they're not wrong, because I think many of us assume, and many in Washington assume, that Pakistan has, you know, exercises a great degree or maybe full control over the Taliban, but that's not the case. The whole group has evolved away from Pakistani control since the 1990s. But in particular, I think the Taliban's field commanders, and this is not stressed enough, really don't feel much obligation in any way to Pakistan. And so Pakistan's role, Pakistan's leverage might be limited over there. And so, you know, again, the Biden administration, I think, is asking Pakistan to help along with the peace process. And Pakistan is saying it'll do all that it can. It wants to retain its sort of privileged position as, you know, the party of importance as it is in Afghanistan. But it also walks this fine line where it says, you know, there are real limits to what it can do.
So I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about the withdrawal announcement in light of U.S. public opinion. You've done some great research on the way that the war in Afghanistan is perceived in the United States. And I'm curious, sort of when you look back, the war has been presided over by two Republican presidents and two Democratic presidents now at this point. I was wondering if you could sort of just place Biden's announcement in the context of U.S. perception of the war in Afghanistan.
Sure. Public opinion is often invoked when talking about the decision to withdraw from Afghanistan, basically calling to a war-weary public, saying the public is wary of these forever wars and these endless wars, and it wants the troops to come home. But I think public opinion is certainly overstated here. There are very vocal groups, both in Congress. There are veterans groups that are vocal about wanting a withdrawal. But when you look at the evidence by and large, especially over the last few years, you know, when this issue has sort of acquired this name of the endless war, forever war, of America's longest war. You know, I think something the Trump administration really pushed this kind of terminology. If you look at the polling data across a number of polls, you see an ambivalent public, you know, a public where a significant proportion of respondents actually don't even respond to the question of whether they prefer troop withdrawals or not, or what their views are. So, you know, you'll have about 20% of people or more not responding to these questions, which is a high percentage. And then you'll essentially have a divided opinion on withdrawal, basically half saying that they prefer U.S. forces to withdraw quickly and the other saying that they don't. And this is across a number of different polls. If you then look at veterans groups, who may presumably have more of an opinion, you do see that, you know, the ambivalence goes away a little bit. So, you know, more of them respond. But again, even they are divided on troop withdrawals. So the takeaway from that then is that we can't actually call on public opinion as the justification for withdrawal. I think we can't really say that this was a political decision that Biden had to make to respond to public opinion or to cater to his base. I think there is no evidence that that is necessarily the case. And so it really appears that this is a decision that the president has made because of his own personal convictions. I mean, I think he has talked, I mean, since he was vice president, but certainly on the campaign trail about ending this endless war. And as he mentioned yesterday, he wanted to be the president who did so. You know, he does not want to hand this war over to the next president. And so that is really what has come into play here.
Great. I think that's a great place to leave it. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please share the Lawfare Podcast and give us a 5-star review on iTunes. Go to thelawfarestore.com for brand new Lawfare pens, lanyards, t-shirts, and socks. The podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patia Howell, and your audio engineer is Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.